Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome to Highly Conflicted, the podcast with me. I'm your host, Hugo Lowell. It's an election podcast for the time being. We'll be talking about all things 2024. And the presidential election with a focus through Donald Trump's eyes. I cover Donald Trump and his legal team, and I'll bring all my reporting to you and to unpack the week's events. And for our inaugural episode, we've got Katie Fang.
Hello.
Friend of the show. Welcome to Highly Conflicted.
I'm honored, actually. It's going to be an amazing podcast. I'm honored to be here.
Well, it's very exciting to have you, not least because the way we conceived this was our chit-chats on the phone when I was driving back from work and you were coming back from Telemundo, and I was like, why don't we just turn this into a podcast?
And it really is. I mean, that's the best part about doing this with you. Anybody who watches and listens to this podcast is going to see literally what you and
right
I
this
do.
Is us in the car
anyway,
right,
when we're in the car and when we're hanging out, and this is kind of a insider track into what our text messages look like as well.
Right, exactly. So this week we've had a big legal week. I don't know, I kind of want to start with the New York case with Donald Trump because his sentencing got pushed back. And we have different views on this, actually, because I think it was better this way, that there was nothing that Judge Merchan could be kind of accused of in terms of inserting politics into the case or giving Trump any ammunition to say that this was election interference, that he was being sentenced or jailed or whatever it may be before the election. But you have a different opinion.
I think that Merchan should have sentenced Donald Trump on September 18th. I mean, I know we haven't gotten to that date yet, but I think he should have done it. I think that he actually did, ironically, interject politics into his decision.
By taking
into account the fact that we are so close to Election Day. And I think that it sent a message, and the wrong one, that there was something of value or validity to that Supreme Court immunity decision that would give anyone cause for pause. So I think it was a bigger kind of disservice that maybe, and maybe I'm being too harsh because I am a fan of Judge Merchan. I think he's handled this case impeccably since day one, and he's had opportunities to either slam Trump or to call out Trump, and he hasn't. He's been really measured. But he's, you know, calling balls and strikes like he's supposed to as a judge. And I feel like he actually wrote in his ruling that, you know, he didn't want to create any type of treatment of Donald Trump like he was a different defendant. And yet he did.
Right.
It's, I don't want to, you know, be mean to you, or what is it? How people say, not to be rude, but
respectfully,
you're rude, or with respect, Your Honor. And there's no respect. So I just kind of feel like when you're reading that, you're like, look. And I also think there should be a little bit of blame apportioned to the Manhattan DA's office. Again,
they didn't oppose it.
And I think his office did an amazing job in this case. It's just, what are you saying? You take a position. Take a position.
Right.
Say that there is no immunity. Say that this guy should be sentenced. I mean, the politicization of this has been done by Trump no matter what happens. You could literally give the man every accommodation, and he's still going to accuse you falsely of being politically persecuted through the judicial system. So why give the guy any quarter? I would not give him any quarter.
I thought it was insane, by the way, that the DA's office didn't oppose, really, the Trump immunity thing, because the minuscule amount of evidence that could even plausibly be, you know, fall into the protected sphere of kind of official acts was the tweets. And to think that the tweets that Trump sent about, you know, Stormy Daniels or anything else was the catalyst that got him convicted is just nuts.
So I'll clear the record just a little bit, though. The Manhattan DA's office does oppose the arguments that the immunity ruling from Supreme Court affords Trump a dismissal of the indictment or the ability to set aside the jury's verdict. What they didn't take a position on was adjournment,
right,
or delay of sentencing.
But they could have made that
motion
argument.
Yes, they could have. And I think that the problem is, you saw Trump then basically bootstrap the silence from the DA's office in a way to support him getting his delay, right? And I get it. I know that the sentencing will happen. I don't believe that the jury verdict's going to be set aside by Judge Merchan, and I don't think Merchan's going to dismiss an indictment on this idea of immunity. But I just feel like there should be more that is done to honor the norms of our judicial system. The norms have been destroyed by Trump. And because of that, there should be a concerted, kind of almost conscious effort to get us back on track. And in my opinion, humble as it is, it would have been Merchan following the process and actually sentencing Trump along the deadlines. Because remember, he had given them the delay. They asked for the delay to be able to brief the immunity. It was given. There was no objection from the DA's office to give them the time. So if you allow them to brief it and it's briefed, and then you move the sentencing from July to freaking September 18th, sentence the guy. Then let him stay out of custody if you really think that it affects his political ability. And yet we heard throughout the duration of this case, even during the trial, that the election considerations weren't going to play into, you know, a factor. They weren't going to be a factor for consideration. Yet I kind of feel like now it is.
Actually, I agree with you, and you've changed my mind slightly on this because
I was a persuasive.
Well, what I want to say is, if he had been sentenced to jail, and then he was like, Judge Merchan was like, actually, I'm sentencing you, but I'm going to defer it pending the election so you can continue to campaign. So you can continue to go on the campaign trail.
Isn't that kind of what he's doing?
But if he had sentenced them and then was been like, but I'm going to stay the sentence. We don't do this for anyone else, but I'm going to, you know, stay the sentence so that you can go campaign.
You, my friend, are a convert now, because that's what I'm trying to say. I feel like he kind of undercut all of like the conscious work that he did along the way of being apolitical, appropriately so. I feel like then he gets to this critical kind of juncture in time, and all he had to do was say, I'm going to move forward. And you know what?
The
they were
going to
appeal
things.
Anyway, right? When he denied the motion to dismiss on the 16th of September, you knew that Trump was going to run to get an appeal. Our good friend Joyce Vance does make a good argument that maybe Trump would have gone to the Supreme Court and it would have messed up who ends up kind of dealing with this. But I still feel like Merchan would have left this unscathed. And I think
And he would have had his code. He would have had his last word. He'd been like, look, while it was in my jurisdiction, I've had the case.
I brought it to the end.
Right. And I'm washing my hands of it maybe if the Supreme Court gets it. But I think I do agree with you now that if he had been, and this is the problem that we have, is every time I talk to you, I end up agreeing with you.
That's not true.
Well, nine times out of ten. But if he had taken a step to sentence him to jail and then pulled back, or even if he made the point that, like, you'll be out on appeal anyway, so what does it matter? You'll still be able to campaign. It's not election interference if you're still doing all your campaign matters. It's not locking you up before the election. Go do your thing, and if you win, hey, you know, good luck to you.
And you know what's the tell here? Is you didn't see Donald Trump do a truth, whatever that stupid thing is that he does. You didn't see him go to his platform and say, look at Merchan doing the right thing and honoring the, you didn't see him say that. You didn't see him say, oh, look at Merchan, kind of whatever. He went and he just did that stupid stuff he always does about how it's a witch hunt. And that's my point. It's an old, tired refrain of a song that we all hate to listen to, but that's because he's an unoriginal guy. And that's why if you're going to say it's a politicized witch hunt anyway, then just do your job
exactly.
And just move ahead with the case. Exactly. I mean, that's why I'm frustrated that we don't have our sentencing on the 18th.
You think he'll be jailed?
Yes.
I don't know. I'm not sure about that.
He's getting jail. 34 felonies. He's getting jail. Even if it's country club jail, he's getting jail.
Okay, but if it's country club... Okay, well, two things. There's a possibility of the country club jail. There's also... How about if it's, like, deferred and he doesn't have to serve any time?
Well, then he should have done it now. I firmly believed if you were going to allow him to defer it before he had to serve any time, do it now. But if he loses in November, then what's the deferral for? What's the deference in any to be paid to this guy? None. I mean, you look so troubled by this.
I'm not troubled by it. I'm just trying to figure out in my head. I mean, I don't know. Who knows? I feel like I just feel like the fact that he delayed it makes me wonder if he is going to sentence Trump particularly harshly.
Oh, so you think that the delay actually inures to the benefit of Trump, not just because it's delayed, but because he's going to be getting a more lenient
sentence? Is Mershon
sentence?
Having second thoughts? Is he being no, you don't think that?
No, Mershon's not that way. He doesn't roll that way. I just think that what's happening here is he does have a sensitivity. Mershon, not being a political judge, has a sensitivity to politics, though, and he's trying to eliminate that component. But my problem is this. Again, it's reason and being rational, and that doesn't exist in Trump world. Right? Think about the arguments that you and I have witnessed when we've been in court. Think about the things we've read from these filings. These are things that are wild, insane, and crazy, and yet somebody's putting their bar number and their signature on these filings and putting them in court.
Well, Alina Hubbard did that in the Eugene Carroll case.
Whatever, so. Alina. Alina still won't come and do my show.
I know, it's very rude. She should have. She said she would. She said she was happy to do any show, and she still has not. Have you tried booking her?
Oh, I'm persona non grata in Trump world. Like, they're never.
Oh no, I know they don't want to be on your show. But Alina did say she would do any show. So we're still.
Well, she complains about not being on TV.
You could put her on, you know, the number one legal show on the weekend on MSNBC. I don't see why she wouldn't do it.
I don't know.
Well, okay, so that's the New York case, and that, actually, there's not that much to talk about in some sense because. The bigger news, I think, was with the D.C. case, the January 6th
with the judge
case.
Who actually did the right thing?
So in that case, she took the opposite view and said, we're not going to take into account any politics whatsoever. Like she said, you know, like, we had this bingo.
She actually said that.
We had this bingo thing going on. Me and Eric Tuck from the AP, we were sitting at the same table as him, and I was like, what's the bingo probability that she says, Mr. Lauro, the election calendar doesn't matter for me? And I obviously won because she did say that.
So was the bingo card with certain words like election?
No, I just said to him before, like, I just be like, I'm going to call it out.
Because my bingo card for Judge Chuckin with Donald Trump would have been like, all the squares would have just had no. Denied or no. And then that's how I would have won Trump bingo with Chuckin, because she would have been like, denied, no, no.
Well, the other thing with her is the eye roll. She does these, like, she sits back and sighs.
Oh, see, I didn't have the benefit of this.
So you need to share this because people need to know,
like, what that's all about.
So as it goes, when John Lauro steps up and goes, like, but Your Honor, Mr. Trump is going to be prejudiced. She sits back and she does this thing where she's like.
So were you the one who was telling me, like, the tea on this is that she actually does like Mr. Lauro? John Lauro, the lawyer for Trump, let's be clear, and that she's kind of doing this dance with him in court because she knows that he has to kowtow to a crappy client like Donald Trump?
So in the very first hearing, or maybe the second hearing that we had in this case, you know, this was back in October, November last year, and Judge Chuckin look at him and say, Mr. Lauro, I understand you have to say these things, and you know, you got your whole spiel that you got to deliver. And Miss Laura's like nodding, and he's like, yes, I have to deliver this. And Todd Blanche, you know, was sitting there like. But that did happen, and B, at the start of the joint status conference, they had a little, you know, back and forth that was kind of like a little jokey, where. And Judge Chuckin's like, oh, Miss Lauro, it's good to see you again.
It's been some time.
And Lauro says something to the effect of, yeah, you know, have I gotten through this time? You know, it's been such a relaxing period. And then she goes like, well, enjoy it while it lasts. So.
Okay, but, like, but hold on for a second, though. So consider what we just talked about with Juan Mershon, right? And then we're now having this conversation about Tanya Chuckin. And there are different courts. One is a New York State court, which is Mershon. One is a federal district court, which is Chuckin. They're procedurally in different postures, though, Hugo. Mershon's case went to trial, jury verdict rendered, right? Chuckin's just kind of getting back into the swing of things, which is why, again, I feel like Mershon kind of lost the plot there. A little bit, because he's already crossed the finish
line.
He
thinks he's done with this case. He doesn't really care.
Other than the sentencing. And right. I just think that we need to kind of stop and pause and kind of give Chuckin her flowers, because she could have easily been like, yeah, we can take some time on this and consider it. No, she like put the pedal to the metal on this, not only getting it back on calendar, which we saw for the status conference, but then she entered an order, as she promised at the end of that day on Thursday, that basically told Donald Trump, y'all need to actually, his lawyers, you guys actually have to earn your fee, and you guys actually have to do the work.
Yeah, and they weren't too happy about that. I mean, we saw the scheduling proposal from the Trump side. It was, they wanted to do all this litigation about their motion to dismiss first, and then they wanted...
It was an insult.
Well, and I reported at the time that it was like they inserted 2 months worth of delay, like on this made up. It's not made up, but there was no reason to put their litigations of the motions about, you know, whether Jack Smith was illegally appointed or not in the place that they did. They did it right before they got to the immunity. And if you look at the scheduling proposal they suggested, it ate up 2 months, which put them past the election.
So here's my question for you, because you are the Trump campaign and Trump legal whisperer, in my opinion, Hugo. Are they just too obvious, they being Trump lawyers? So when they file that type of ridiculousness in the joint status report where they say, we want to deal with appointments first, insane. And then immunity later, like, don't you think that's an insult to somebody like Judge Chutkan, who's just too smart? Like, it's just too cute by half when I see them do those filings.
I think it was very cute. I think, at this point, I also think they don't care either. I think they've reached the point where they're like, well, we're not going to get the trial before the election. That was our main focus. So we're just going to, you know, we're just going to fuck about and we're going to do whatever we need to do here. And, you know, we'll kick it down the road a little bit. I think there's also like a certain, they were riding high after the documents case got dismissed. They were riding high after the SCOTUS decision. And, you know, they know no matter what happens in the next few months and weeks and, you know, the rest of the January 6th case, it's going to be appealed and they're going to go through all of this again. And so I think
you're giving them way too much credit, though, they being Trump legal. Both the classified documents dismissal and the indictment was done at the hands of Judge Cannon, and the win that they just got from SCOTUS was done by SCOTUS. This was not done by the Trump lawyers. There is no amount of skilled lawyering that's going on right now that is like, oh, I'm outmaneuvering Jack Smith because they're bad lawyers. That's not what's happening. So if we're being very honest about the wins, quote unquote, that Trump has acquired over the last, I don't know, three months, those have been done because of other people, other parties, other hands. It hasn't been because of Trump legal.
I think that's fair. I mean, I will say, look, they did file the motions. They did think to do the, let's just, you know, I mean, it was a Hail Mary, but let's do
Which
the presidential
one?
Immunity and let's do the presidential immunity appeal. You know, they still have to file it. And I don't know that the previous set of lawyers would never necessarily have thought to do that. In fact, I think there was like one of my colleagues spoke to another Trump lawyer and they were like, yeah, that was a good decision. So, I mean, this is what happens when you scrape the bottom of the barrel anyway. But, you know, at least they filed it. But I think I get your point, which is accurate about.
Because when they actually go to court and they actually do things like a trial, either civil or criminal, how does it end up for Donald Trump?
Yeah, it was bad. Bad.
E. Jean Carroll. Lost twice.
Right.
New York AG's office, Letitia James, they lost, right?
Right.
And then when he went to trial in front of the Manhattan DA's office case, right? Lost. I mean, he's
batting a
thousand. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. I mean, people seem to underestimate the fact that there are like forces at play that are going on right now that have nothing to do with your litigation skills as a lawyer, which is why you can put somebody like Alina Haba up and say, hey, go and do something.
But they're still taking credit, right? That is the one. They're still going to take credit no matter what. And so
with Donald Trump standing there saying how he thinks his legal team's so
crappy. Well, we'll get to that. We will get to him shitting on his legal team. But it is also, I think, true that they look at the landscape and they think, oh, you know, we were responsible for this. Whether or not that is true or not, they are taking credit for it internally, and I think that is also informing their worldview when they're finding, like, let's just throw this against the wall. Let's see what else sticks, because we've been so successful with this so far.
Well, I mean, as a lawyer, you don't do that, right? Like, as a lawyer, you're not supposed to do that. Well, they do it, and so here's my question for you then. How much money do you think these people have made doing this?
Well, you can see the FEC reports. Todd Blanche has made a lot of money. Him and Emil Bove, their new Blanche law firm, has made a lot of money. I think they've probably exceeded $1 million. I know Evan Corcoran in the documents case exceeded $1 million, and he really wasn't doing very much at all. You know, other than
writing his memoir on attorney-client privileged or so, non-attorney-client
right,
privileged,
exactly.
that's exactly what he was doing.
Okay, but Evan Corcoran, you know, I think Evan Corcoran made a lot of money. He made about $1 million. Maybe $1 million plus, and he didn't do very much. There are some lawyers who've made a lot less money, I have to say. The disparity in the payments have been quite extraordinary.
And who's been gatekeeping those payments? Like, is Boris the one who's sitting there, like, looking at the invoices saying, oh, yeah, you get paid?
I don't know the answer
to
that.
Or is it, like, Oprah style? Like, you get $1 million, and you get $1 million, and
well,
you
Chris
get
Kyes got his $3 million retainer up front.
And nobody has ever seen or heard from Chris Kyes ever again.
Well, what happened was he got demoted to the civil litigation team during the documents case. He got pushed out by Jim Trusty and Tim Pollitore, and then basically Chris Keyes went away.
Hugo Lowell's palace intrigue.
It's 100% accurate. And then he's made a reappearance in some of these cases. And what I was told was they couldn't get rid of him because Trump was like, I've already paid this guy. We need to extract as much money out of him as possible. And so Boris and Trump decided to keep him on. And he's just kind of like a slave to them now, where they just make him do stuff that, you know, they don't want to do or the other lawyers don't want to do. And they're like, well, you got your $3 million, so you can't complain now.
Well, I will tell you this. I do think November is a very momentous kind of decision inflection point for America in many different ways. But I think if you're Trump legal, you're watching that very carefully. Because if Trump loses in November, those legal cases are going to go full freight. And the question ends up being, do you then revamp your legal team? And do you punt all of these people somewhere else? Because you really do have to worry about incarceration if you're Donald Trump. Or do you say, I'm going to keep this JV squad of lawyers that I have, because to your point, I've paid them all this money and I'm kind of stuck like Chuck with really, you know, with what I have. I mean, that is why, and you've said this before, Hugo, Trump's running to stay out of prison. He's not running, you know, for office to be able to provide for Americans. He's running for office so that he doesn't have to be prosecuted anymore.
Yeah, and it's an interesting question about the legal team. I don't know. Well, you know, Todd Blanche, the lead lawyer, has himself a decision to make, right? Because if Trump wins, my sources tell me that he could get any job legal-wise that he wanted. If he wanted to
be... Are you talking like AG?
Well, I don't know if he wants that. I think what he is gunning for is White House counsel. So Todd Blanche could be White House counsel in a second Trump admin. And that's the best case scenario, right? But if Trump loses, what is Todd going to do? Right. So does he...
Where's the money go? Where's the money come from?
Well, there's still several millions in Save America PAC.
For that?
Well, I mean, he keeps the... depending on how much
You
he
think
spends.
That man's going to lose in November and then spend his money on legal fees?
Well, he might have to. I mean, if I was Trump, that's the hedge I would make, right? Is mm-hmm. I might lose the election, and then I might have to...
But still have a war chest to be...
And then I have all these legal cases coming down the pike. I'm going to squirrel away maybe like 10, 15 million to pay for my legal fees going forward.
Are you
going to
start hawking your gold sneakers more?
Add a million at a pop, then maybe. But Trump's got a decision to make, but the lawyers do as well. Like, do you want to stick around? Like, do you want to lose more cases and ruin your reputation?
I'm going to dispatch you to go find out what's going to happen on this, because I sincerely believe there's going to be a massive regime change when Trump loses in November, when it comes to his legal team, because I think because he knows what his exposure is, I think he knows that he's going to have top level talent to be able to get through what's about to come to him.
Yeah.
Let alone the fact that he will have a sentencing at the end of November.
That's going to be painful for him. I think it's like I don't think he's prepared for, if he loses, I don't think he's prepared mentally or at all for what's coming down the pike. I think he's
going to... You mean like in terms of going to jail?
Yeah. I mean, it won't be immediate, right? He will still appeal and all this. But I don't know that Trump has figured out in his own head what is, you know, the world of hurt that could be awaiting him if he loses. I think he knows in general terms, but I don't think it's hit him yet.
So here's my next question. So what we haven't talked about, and just really quickly I want to talk about, is there was another court hearing for Trump in front of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in New York on E. Jean Carroll's first successful verdict against Donald Trump for defamation and sexual abuse. That was the $5 million that she got, et cetera. That was the appeal that Trump has taken of the successful verdict that E. Jean Carroll got against him. Donald Trump went to that one. Why? Why did Donald Trump go to an appellate court argument that was a whopping 20 minutes in front of the Second Circuit of all the stuff that he could have been dealing with? Why did he go to that?
I don't have an answer for you. I think, I don't know. Why would Trump go to that? I mean, I'm trying to think aloud a little bit. He did have the economic club speech to do. So maybe it all dovetailed.
So it was geographically convenient for the guy to go to court? He didn't even go to the trial, is my point. The guy was a no-show for the actual trial with E. Jean Carroll.
Wait, didn't he go to some days?
For the second? Remember, he had two of them. So... I mean, right. He might have rolled up for one, but I guess what I'm trying to say is you don't even go to the trial.
Because remember he made those eyes at, he made that
fit.
Yeah,
I think it was the second one.
That was the second one.
Yeah. But you don't even go to the trial in the first place. And then you go for 20 minutes of oral argument, 10 of which was Robbie Kaplan kicking their ass. Like, I don't get this. And I know, and I've written a piece about it, that Boris Epstein.
Epstein like Einstein. Is how
like
he says
Einstein
it.
Bagels?
That, well, that's not the Einstein he's thinking about, but yeah.
I know that he's, quote, quarterbacking all of this. So I legitimately want to know, is that also strategy? Like, as in, Boris is deciding when Trump is going to show up? Because it's a big deal when he shows up in court, because it never happens.
What would be the reason, from a defense lawyer perspective, to put your client, to bring your client to an appellate hearing?
You think they have any control over this guy?
Well, no, I'm just thinking. Like, is there a? Let's just is there a good?
I can't game it out. What are you going to do? You're going to go and what? Intimidate E. Jean and Robbie in court? Why didn't you go to the trial when maybe it would have been more effective? I just don't. There is no reason, or like, it's so irrational, and I literally cannot. You do a better job of this than I do. I cannot put my mind and my brain in that space. Because it's so far afield of just sanity that I don't even know how to do that.
Yeah, I don't.
But that's your homework. You need to go tell me why that guy actually went to the Second Circuit.
Well, Trump does weird campaign stops as well sometimes. So it's, you know, he kind of just wings it sometimes.
This is the perfect segue there for us to talk about what he did at the Second Circuit, though.
Well, what did he do?
Well, I don't know, Mr. Reporter Man.
Well, okay, so he went to Trump Tower, and it was billed as a press conference. Of course, it was not a press conference. It was a statement. The National Weather Service downgraded it as Dave Weigel's
airing of grievances. It is what I call the Trump Festivus. It's when he goes and he just sucks the oxygen. I don't know how he can, because he's so big. I bet you his like pulmonary respiratory system is just completely compromised. But then he sucks all the oxygen out of the room and just stands there. And what I love about it, it's almost like North Korean in nature, because it's like he makes all the minions stand, though, like behind him, like faithful, dutiful soldiers. And he just berates them. Well, here's the tragic thing. It's not like he does it to their faces, because they're all staring at his ass. Like, it's just kind of crazy. Like, right. He's just standing there, and they're all staring at him, and they can't say anything, and their faces, they're not maintaining poker faces.
And the lineup behind him was the full team. It was Alina Harbaugh, who was one of the lead counsels in the E. Jean Carroll case and lost.
Lost.
It was Todd Blanche, who was the other lead counsel.
Lost.
It was Boris Epstein, who oversees the legal team and the liaison.
Quarterbacking losses.
There was who else? Emil Bove, who was on the New York criminal trial team, which lost. Right. And they had Will Schaaf, who did some of the appellate stuff.
I don't even know who that dude is. Like, legit. Like, I don't even know who that guy is. Isn't he like running for office or something?
He is. And the backstory with him is he was trying to get Trump's endorsement, but there was a faction divide inside Trump world, and it was very messy.
What else is new?
And then the one successful lawyer in that group was John Sauer, who argued before the Supreme Court and got the immunity ruling.
Okay, so I'm going to define successful a little bit differently than you. I will concede
for Trump
that success, if you're going to define it as the Supreme Court, the conservative supermajority on the Supreme Court agreed that there's presidential immunity for stuff that I don't agree. If you think it's a win as a lawyer to stand there and tell a D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals and then the Supreme Court that you can dispatch SEAL Team 6 to assassinate your political opponent, you know what, John? You can take that win. I personally sleep better not taking that win.
Okay. Well, all right. So that's the legal then. So that's the week that we have had. And then the week that is coming is going to be also a pretty momentous week for Trump.
First presidential debate, maybe only presidential debate, between Kamala Harris and
Donald J. Trump. And so when we're looking at this through Donald Trump's eyes, which is what this podcast is about, we're gonna bring you from behind the scenes of what is going on inside Donald Trump's brain as much as is possible, and his team at Mar-a-Lago. What do we think is his biggest weakness? And is it going to be the racist, misogynistic, caustic stuff that he says, or is it that he...
Yeah, but that's fodder for his... But
is it
going to
be gibberish?
Though,
right, you know? So is that the biggest issue for him, or is it like when he gets into gibberish and starts saying like childcare is, you know, tax credit?
For the debate, you mean?
Yes.
So, you know what's interesting? I actually thought he was a lot more measured than I expected him to be when he did that debate with Joe Biden. And I don't know if it's because he's crazy like a fox and we all kind of underestimate his ability to regulate himself. But if the conditions for the debate on Tuesday with Kamala Harris are this controlled environment, he may be able to pull off what he did in that first debate with Joe Biden. But here's where I'm going to tell myself that I'm wrong, because Joe Biden is not Kamala Harris. And I think Kamala Harris has done an effective job through her team, especially her social media team, of really putting him on his back foot and being on defense. They, as in Kamala HQ and that whole crew, they use his own words against him. They use J.D. Vance's own words against J.D. Vance. They don't have to kind of go outside to some external source to get the ammunition. He's giving them the fodder in and of itself. I feel like what's going to happen on Tuesday is if Kamala Harris just let Donald Trump be Donald Trump, she's just going to be able to mine this like ridiculous abundance of riches of absolute campaign material to pull from that debate. Because Trump can't help himself. At least I don't think he can when he's against a woman and a woman of color.
But what do you think he's going to say that's like, it's going to be bad? Is he going to say something that like, what are the headlines the next day? Like, what are they going to focus on? Like, what's his biggest weakness in that sense?
It depends on who he takes his cues from, right? So if he takes his cues from the questions that are posed by the moderators, I do think that maybe, like, for example, if there's a question about the border, he'll be like, she's the border czar, or whatever. I don't do the imitation as well as you do. But it depends if he takes his cues from the questions or if he does and then he goes off on tangents like he does. I do think, though, and this is a really kind of big question mark, how much do you see Kamala Harris leaning into the prosecutor versus felon rhetoric and dialogue or whatever? And I'm wondering, does Donald Trump go there? Meaning, does he then say she slept her way to the top? Right? Like, does he get that down and dirty?
You could
look skeptical. Like, you don't think he would actually
do that. I don't know. It depends on the Trump you get on the day. And like, this is kind of how the Trump advisors are seeing it. And this is how we kind of reported it, is you either get happy Trump, who's in a good mood and is kind of sharp for him. And, you know, he's quippy like he was with Joe Biden. And I think, you know, the one thing that Trump did that was kind of widely shared on social afterwards was like the stuff about the golf. And, you know, when Biden got jumbled up about Medicare.
But does he rehearse that, though? Because we've heard reporting that he doesn't prepare.
He doesn't
so that's
prepare.
Just him, like his
him
off
riffing,
the cuff.
Yes. Oh. As far as I can tell.
Well, was it even a blind squirrel finds a nut?
Well, so, he found it twice. He did that, and then he got
a broken clock is correct twice a day. So
well,
there you go.
So that's what the Trump guys are hoping for, right? The Trump campaign is hoping that they get happy Trump, where he's quippy and he's like he makes these off the cuff remarks, and they want the Trump that they got in the debate with Hillary when he says like, "Oh, because you'll be in jail."
But the only common denominator through all of these things is Donald Trump, meaning. The Donald Trump you see at any of these debates, whether it's happy Trump or psychotic Trump, it's still Donald Trump. When you say happy Trump versus Hillary Clinton, Hillary Clinton's not Kamala Harris either. I mean, I feel like the wild card here is Kamala Harris. I know that sounds obvious to say, but I also think she's younger than him. Like, what time is this debate, by the way?
8 p.m., I think. Maybe
later. Oh, it's not later?
Maybe it is.
Well, he's the oldest guy running for president of the United States right now, so it's past his bedtime, one. And two, she's younger than him. She's faster than him. She can pivot. I mean, she's got professional training and experience to be able to deal with thinking on her feet. He doesn't know how to think.
That's true.
Feet.
Okay, so that's one of many major assets that Harris has is – as a former prosecutor, she is going to be quick at thinking on her feet.
She has to do.
Right, this is what we will talk about. And I guess that's the one thing that the Trump campaign is looking at. The second thing they're looking at is, well, can she sass, quote-unquote, sass her way through the debate in, like, difficult moments for her? And the Trump campaign seems to think that if she gets a difficult question, she'll be like, "Oh, stop it!" Or next question. Or she will make some sort of sassy remark.
Oh, I don't think she'll sass the moderators. I don't
Interesting.
Think so.
You think she'll sass Trump?
Yes.
Even with 100%. with the mics off?
I think what she has perceived accurately as being successful thus far has been the authenticity of who she is. Right? She hasn't apologized for her laugh. She hasn't apologized for being a woman. She hasn't apologized for achieving everything she's achieved. I think that she would never show, quote unquote, sass. I mean, she may do her own quips maybe to a question that's posed by the moderators, but I think she's going to reserve her kind of like bite for Donald Trump, when he says it, how he says it, etc. And I actually expect her to engage him more. I think that makes him get off his game, not the like, let me answer the moderator kind of this way. I think if she looks at him and she points at him and she does this, he's going to freak the you know what out.
I think that's right. And I think if she confronts him directly like that and looks across the stage and makes that sort of finger pointing comment, Trump will turn and look at him because he likes that sort of confrontation. And I think if he gets to that point, it could be game over for him. I think this is his big major weakness, not just about people. Like we talk about, like, you know, he struggles with women, he struggles with like black women especially. But I think if someone's in his face and like kind of being aggressive and fighting towards him, he can't resist clamping back. And I think if he does that, even if you previously had happy Trump, suddenly you might get nasty Trump and, you know, hyper-aggressive Trump and psychotic Trump, and that's not where he wants to be.
So my question for you, though, because, again, you are so, like, tuned in and dialed into all of the Trump campaign stuff as well, not just the Trump legal. My question is he legit not preparing? Because I feel like that's such a red herring for the public, having the Trump campaign being like, the guy is a professional debater, so he doesn't need to prepare. Is that true? Or is that just a smokescreen and he's like furiously preparing behind the scenes with, I don't know, I'll pick like Kimberly Guilfoyle as Kamala Harris?
I think it's somewhere in the middle. It's not, he's not, as far as I can tell, and based on our reporting, he is not doing sit down mock debates with people, you know, standing up and pretending to be like Harris. What he is doing, he is sitting down with people like Tulsi Gabbard, and he's going through what they call policy sessions, because they can't bring themselves to call it, you know, debate for whatever reason, so they call it policy sessions.
Oh, but his actual policy?
They talk about like the topics that they think will come out, and like I think he kind of thinks them through. So I don't know, it's somewhere in the middle from what we can understand.
So
is that, I don't know, does that answer your question?
Well, I'm going to cross-examine you now. So I'm going to be former lady prosecutor. No. Isn't it true, though, Mr. Lowell, that we heard evidence and we read evidence during the course of the Manhattan DA's trial that when the Access Hollywood tape broke, well, prior to it coming out, that information was provided to Michael Cohen and others, and they interrupted his prep for a debate at that time to let him know and let the members know of his campaign about the existence of the story that was going to come out?
Yes, but you got to also remember, like, he's changed. Like, he's changed in the last two cycles.
More decrepit. Is that what you're saying?
I think, I don't know if I call him decrepit. What has changed is his approach, and he has become much less trusting. He does his prep, you know, his prep with a smaller number of advisors. He does it with people he thinks he can be kind of himself with. It's a much smaller group. It's not like, not like how it was.
And yet, though, again, if I may, he surrounds himself with the same people from 2016. Corey Lewandowski, Jason Miller. I mean, the cast of characters is the same. It's not like he's figured out that he needs to do Trump campaign version 2.0, better, faster, stronger.
Well, he tried that. He tried that in 2020.
But that's my thing.
And he didn't like it. So he has gone back to the 16 group, but he himself has changed, I think. Having observed him now for several years, you know, there are people who covered him longer, but having seen him in the post-presidency life, I do think he has changed. I think he is more insular. But I also think, you know, he also gets a lot of what he thinks is practice. He goes to rallies and he makes all the points that he wants to make.
But he
remembers the lines.
So the guy has the capacity to remember one-liners that he thinks are true zingers that are just racist and misogynistic and terrible, and he thinks that that's going to be enough for a debate? I mean, listen, if that's what he wants to do and deploy, that's on him. But
what I have noticed increasingly in his ad-lib remarks at rallies, when he's not looking at the prompt and he tells these stories, the stories are the same. He does have a capacity to remember them, even ad-libbing. It's funny that they don't actually write it into the script, because clearly this is not something that they want him necessarily talking about. But then he goes on about, like, I remember at Mar-a-Lago, we were once sitting there listening to this hour and a half. It was, I think it was the night of the midterms, or maybe the week before. and he was talking about the, you know, how they're bringing these, the buses of migrants are coming over with like fentanyl strapped to caravans. Their backs, the caravans. But like, if I just remember it, because he was like, and the buses are lining up at the border to come in. Like, it was such an absurd image.
It's demonstrably false.
It's just total bullshit. But the way he was describing it was so funny, it was so memorable that the next time he delivered that line at a rally I went to, and I could see he wasn't looking at the prompter, he was just riffing. But clearly, I think he remembers like images and moments and kind of stories in his head. And he just likes to repeat them, and so I think in that sense he gets a lot of repetition. I wouldn't call it practice. He gets repetition at delivering stories.
That's what some old people do. I want you to know. You're too young to know this, Hugo, but that's what some old people do. Just letting you know.
Like
the
ranting
repetition
at
of stories, the angry old man memes shouting at the cloud. Right? How about the Trump screaming at the kid mowing the lawn?
That's like, the funniest meme.
But that is what you're telling me. Like, that's what he's leaning into. And if that's old hat Trump, he's going to get his ass kicked on Tuesday.
Well, let's see. So let's see about the debate, because it's obviously going to be a big moment. And, you know, who knows? Because, you know, Team Harris also have their own concerns, right? And this was actually, you know, something I was talking to someone recently about, which was she has the unfortunate position in being modern day America of a woman, and not just a woman but a black woman. And if she there's this chit chat about if she comes off as too strong, like, you know, kind of white voters will be like, oh, you know, she's a little too strong for us. But then if she doesn't kick back hard enough, they'll be like, oh, she was intimidated. And in a sense, there is do you think there's this possibility that she can't win whatever she does unless she's perfect?
So I'm going to share a small anecdote with you, because it answers the question. When I first started as a felony trial prosecutor in Miami-Dade County, I was 26 years old, 27 years old. And I had to try all of these cases, and I was just trying so hard to do the right thing and to try these cases and to win, et cetera. And this judge who I was appearing in front of pull me aside, because I always wanted the constructive criticism on how I could do better. And he told me, he said, look, Katie, I know you went to Yale for undergrad and you are clearly very smart. He's like, you have a very big vocabulary, et cetera. He's like, but that's not what jurors want. These jurors don't really care what your undergrad degree is, and frankly, they'll never really know. These jurors look at you as the prosecutor, and what they want to see is somebody who's willing to roll up her sleeves and get into kind of into the trenches with them, right? Hmm. And to be there with them, like alongside them in some way. And that stuck with me, because I felt like what he was trying to say in a more polite way, right, than what I'd given myself the grace for, was I was trying too hard to be something or someone that I'm not. And that's why I think authenticity is the key. So if Kamala Harris continues to be the authentic her, who she is, whether she, quote, sasses or not, whether she appropriately shows anger when it is the time to do, I don't really think she has the luxury of caring anymore. We are going to be less than 60 days from Election Day when that debate happens on Tuesday. And I think that if she comes and she just is herself, she has nothing to lose, right? I mean, literally, Hugo, I mean, the stakes are so high. She has been catapulted into a race right before the finish line. So I don't care if I am her that some Republican in Wherno, God knows what, thinks I'm an angry black woman if I raise my voice in anger over what he says to me or what he says is just wrong. I don't think she loses any ground or credibility. And if she does, then I don't think that voter or that prospective voter has really looked at who she is. I think that was part of the reason why she didn't have such a successful 2020 run either, right? When she was trying to deal with everybody in a crowded primary. I think
she was trying to be someone else.
Exactly. I think if you are who you are, I think you have success no matter what you do in whatever industry space. I just think when it comes to this, she and Tim Walz are running on being genuine. And I think that is the key to her success on Tuesday.
It'll be interesting to see, because we also have reporting that the bottom line with Trump right now is he doesn't really have a plan to land effective attacks on Harris. And part of, I think, what his team is looking at with this debate is a bit of a reset moment. But, and you know, we have reported at The Guardian that they realize nothing they do between now and the debate, and this has been the case for about 2 weeks now, nothing they do between now and then in the debate was going to cut through the news cycle. Nothing was going to move the needle in a significant way. And so they have been looking at the debate as a moment to not only try and show that, you know, Trump is still here, number one, but also to deliver the talking points that he wants the media to cover more.
But it's all unoriginal, though. It's going to be border immigration. It's going to be economy, right? And then it's going to be what? She's really soft on crime. So she was, you know, or the flip, she wrongly imprisoned a whole bunch of young people of color as a DA. I mean, it's you want to yawn. There's something that's wholly unoriginal, Hugo, which is why I think that his biggest challenge is going to be himself on Tuesday. It's not Kamala Harris, it's him. He's his biggest enemy going into Tuesday.
Okay, Katie, well, thank you for being with us for an inaugural episode.
Thank you for letting me be a part of your maiden voyage into the land podcast.
Yes, the maiden voyage. So thank you, and...
I even have a prop for your first episode.
Okay.
Yes, Guac is so extra. Guac is extra, but so am I. This is actually not me. This is Hugo. So Hugo, here's a little bit of a prop and a gift for you.
Thank you. I accept this honorary award, the Guac is Extra award, as it will be.
Now it's time for you to go feed me guac. So
yes.
Let's go get some
guac. All right, we're going to get guac. All right.
Let's get some guac.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.